wasn't just a flickering between water surface undulance and particular liquid ripple, in other words, between the forest and the tree. The memory of swimming led me, without a plan, to the title of Chuck's long sequence, The Forest for the Trees. And so, as I was attending to these images and these thoughts, I was also moving, participating in the image making and reading. Right, making the images, reading the images, flickering between them. As I repeatedly knifed out through the water, then pushed a portion behind me. And when I make this gesture on land, it's a bit like opening curtains. Right, it's the breaststroke. It's a bit like opening curtains, as if for a performance. And behind me, I enact frog's legs, and I project myself through the cove, partially on top and partially beneath the water. And even now, I feel that sort of post-long swim feeling. If some of you have, I'm a bit underwater even now as I speak. And I thought that somehow this was the perfect sort of image, but it wasn't just an image, right? Because it was enacted for my experience of not only looking at his images and reading his poems, but also talking to Chuck, which is what we're going to get to sort of hear him today with us. And this was a sort of way of short time capturing some of this amazing, vitally important conversation that we had yesterday, which is sort of an extension and permutation of this ongoing engagement. And if you have a chance after today and you're interested in engaging or sort of another way of engaging with Charles Olson, his book, The Black Chrysanthemum, helped me get back into, and I've said this before publicly, but I'll say it again, helped me get back into Olson, find my own Olson after really needing to kind of leave him, set him aside for about a decade, being overwhelmed by it. So Charles Stein has been vitally important, particularly in The Black Chrysanthemum, as I mentioned, and when he discusses Olson's Jungian heresy of the particular concrete local embodiment of the archetypes. And this is something that is we can sort of needs to be even fleshed out more, as we were talking about the other day, the permutation of Olson's uses of his reading. And then this led me back to this last thought, which is this idea that I'm just sort of starting to understand as in our time, that the long poem is can no longer be or can no longer vitally be a single unified total image, totalizing image, but is something that is always emergent or evolving. And this brings us back to that title, Forest for the Trees, and brings us back to another long poem or long sequence that Chuck has been working on, and will share some of that with us tonight. So, Chuck Stein.
So this microphone works at a distance like this?
That's
good. Great. Okay.
It's just for the recording.
Okay, yeah. Well, this thing called The Forest for the Trees was the name I gave to the point in my life when it seemed like now's the time to project a vast poem. And I had this feeling of, from the sense of the long poems of my life that I was familiar with. This doesn't mean like I know all the long poems, but Olson's Maximus and Pound's Cantos and Williams Patterson and Zukofsky's A, that they all went under some kind of continuous transformation in a way that moved to a point that was very much not what the authors expected them to be at the outset. Not that that isn't something that perhaps is not completely uncommon before, but it impressed me as being a situation, and that the projection of your long poem that was to be your ontology, your total picture, your total view of the world, wasn't something that I was actually interested in committing myself to, even though I was interested in scale and blowing something up to some intensity. So I called this thing that I started The Forest for the Trees, which I write with all the words running together, the forest for the trees without spaces between them. And the idea was that this wasn't going to be a long poem, but it was going to be in the name for the writing that I would do on a daily basis, or whatever writing I would do. And then when I published poems, individual poems, groups of poems, sequence of poems, series of poems, gave readings, gave performances, whatever would happen, it would always say, "From the Forest for the Trees." So there would be this sort of sense of a relationship between the writing activity as a general background for what actually would emerge. And I kept that up until 3 years ago, when something very peculiar happened. I started actually writing a long poem. And this poem sort of is an implosion within The Forest for the Trees. It has a definite boundary. It's at the moment humongously extravagant. It's about 1,200 pages long. And it was based on a matrix or a system it has a system. And what I think what I'll do is only say one or two words about it, or 7 or 11 words, and then I'll read some of it, and then perhaps if you're interested, I'll talk about what the thing was. If anybody was here 3 years ago when I read some sections of the very, very beginning of it. However, before I read from that, I want to read one translation from among the Homeric hymns. This is in kind of perverse, ironic, transcendental, intensified celebration of this thing that happened in England yesterday. So now there's King George the VII has been announced. And it's the Homeric hymn to the god Pan. And I think there's probably some difference between his emergence into the world and this King George's emergence into the world, but you can get that from the sense of the poem. These Homeric hymns are poems that are written in the poetic dialect, as it were, of the Homeric poems of the Iliad and the Odyssey. And they were believed to have been read as introductions to performances of the Homeric poems. And there are maybe 33 or 34 of them. And the reason this long poem thing happened is probably owing to the fact that I have spent the last 6 years or so translating the Iliad and the Odyssey. So longness got into my habit. And so having translated both of these, I now had that. So, Hymn to Pan. Tell me, Muse, about the dear child of Hermes, the one with two horns and the feet of a goat, who loves to stir up a rumpus. He wanders to and fro with the dancing nymphs through woody meadows. They romp about on any sheer cliff's edge, calling to Pan, the shepherd's god, bright-haired and quite disorderly. Rocky peaks and mountain tops and every snowy summit are his haunts. Here and there he trundles through thick brushwood, attracted now by gentle rivulets, now drawn to ascend the highest peak for viewing sheep flocks. And often he runs through the blessed glittering mountains, and often he drives through the foothills slaughtering beasts, this sharp-eyed glancing god. Then in the evening, back from the wilds, he starts up his music, playing reed pipes so sweetly that, at fashioning melodies, not even the bird, who pours forth her threnody in springtime, uttering honey-voiced song among the leaves, is better than he. With him at that hour are the clear-voiced mountain nymphs, wandering on nimble feet and singing by some dark spring, while echo moans about the mountain tops. The god, on this side and that, around the dancers, then sidling in their midst, plies his nimble feet. And he sports a ragged lynx pelt on his back, delighting his heart with searing tunes there on gentle meadows, where crocuses mix with fragrant hyacinths, flourishing at random in the grass. The nymphs and he sing of the blessed gods on high Olympus, and tell perhaps of Hermes swift as death, choosing him from among the deities, how Hermes is speedy courier for all the gods, and how he came to Arcadia, mother of flocks, with many fountains. This is his sacred district as deity of Kalene. And there, though he is a god, he used to shepherd flocks with curly fleeces, because a flaming passion flourished in him to merge in love with Dryop's daughter, a nymph with beautiful tresses, and he did wed her. She bore a dear son to Hermes in the halls, from the very first a prodigy to look at. He had two horns and the feet of a goat, and loved to laugh a lot and stir up a clatter. As soon as the nurse took a peek at him, seeing the boy's coarse countenance and full-grown beard, she was terrified, leapt up, ran away, abandoned the little fellow. But Hermes, swift as death, accepted him, and took him into his hands, glad beyond measure. Lightly he sped to the seats of the immortals, hiding the child in the warm skin of a mountain hare, and set him down beside Zeus and the other immortals, and showed them his son. And all the gods were happy at heart, in particular Bacchic Dionysus. And they called him Pan, because he made all of them happy. So here is greetings to you, O Lord. I sue for your graciousness for the song. And now I shall remember you and make another song as well. So now the problem is which of the bloody sections to read. The thing is enormous, and probably the best way is to read a kind of continuous run of them from a given section. And until this instant, I haven't decided which run to read. But here goes. Okay, here it is. Each of the long, maybe 10 sections of this poem has a title, which is a phrase which is by some process encoded within the entire section. So this piece is called Never Tire of the Road, and it's from a line by an Irish folk singer named Andy Irvine, and it's dedicated to Woody Guthrie. So Never Tire of the Road is his road, but it also is a kind of phrase for the work of radical activism and the hope of a revolution. So never tire of the road. And this poem has, in a peculiar way, projected into it imaginary or imaginative transformations of events from the Occupy Wall Street events. There was an Occupy Poughkeepsie down in the Hudson Valley where I live that we were a part of, and at a certain point in these poems, the night that the encampment was taken down, we were there all night, and this thing, part of it was written during those events. That's not by any means all of what this is, and it's sort of projected into it, but I just sort of give that as a little piece of it. So I'll read. There are 26 sections in each of these large sections, and so I will just give the numbers of them just for the sake of identification. Never Tire of the Road, 17. The old hotel hired a new doorkeep. This one eschewed deployment of any African rattle, whether cowrie mouthed or plain brown charred gourd skin, for the rattle surface. No magic. Inexperienced as he was, the freshman doorkeep formed a liaison with a hammerhead. Jacinth, seated at her cauldron, construing the whole world, was definitely out. There had been complaints. Not everyone liked her world or their position in it. A fork in the timeline was called for. Hammerhead, for all the checkered variety of his avatars, had never manifested as doorkeep. Jaguar, in general, kept him at a distance, so that the exuberance of each never compromised either. Jacinth's world was shunted into just one chamber. She could keep her focus at her cauldron to amuse the guests. The doorkeep would see to it that the more exotic features of her ontology would remain exotic. Snakes and eagles. Hammerhead was happy to play the enforcer, while Jaguar was free to prowl about in silence or otherwise explore happenstance as he saw fit. How would the new doorkeep orient Crystal? Natural nemesis or instrument of focus? Would the doorkeep make use of his opal? A sentinel, after all, responds to happenstance. Happenstance addresses the doorkeep without reference to forethought or courage. If there's good order in the garden, if the jaguar and his avatars remain in colloquy with Black Lake, if the fumes of the gorge keep inside it, the doorkeep at the big black door of the old hotel could busy himself watering the violets, if the gorge is silent and the world at large advertises no amazement and behaves just as if it were asleep. Forks, in general, was his nemesis. You would find none at all in the closets and hefty wooden cabinets of the old hotel. The doorkeep's personal ritual and the extent of his personal courage was to keep things perfectly linear, if not exactly lineal. It was not always possible. If the sentinel acquired the form of an avatar of Hammerhead, forking was one process by which avatars become proliferate, and the doorkeep himself would generate avatars. When the old hotel multiplied entrances or chambers or unaccountably welcomed avatars of its own nemesis, the sentinels would have to invent tactics to manage such happenstance, and happenstance itself from time to time manifest jaguars, avatars or multiple jaguars, and how would one tell? Call on Hammerhead, the archetype himself, if you can attract him, because you had equipped yourself with his form. But that would be magic, wouldn't it? It seemed this job might prove to be a long river. The doorkeep might even need a doorkeep, even have to pluck up a doorkeep's courage, perform a doorkeep's magic, lest melee come out of obliquity, ratchet up in one's habitude the doorkeep's revenge, and open the door to unmanageable hammerheads. And there are many kinds of silence that at times pervade the old hotel, not all of them restful. One is the nemesis of the doorkeep, for deep storage under the floorboards collects a tariff of silence, and payment is not voluntary. He who is remiss and tries to keep all his tranquil commodities suffers sleep that is a melee. Its silence is broken by 10,000 hammerheads, every one a purveyor of obliquity. And jaguars lurk in the garden, and the garden is hospitable to jaguars. You had best work out an arrangement with Wrench Boy, for he has an arrangement with Melee. And then there is Black Lake, whose silence echoes through the gorge, and a silence that is pure and spiritual, and as doorkeep you must know how to seek it, even from the gorge, a true, if unlikely, source for it. And remember, for a doorkeep of the old hotel, superficial dignity is your bulwark, your refuge, that and a fistful of violets. 20. Long River guarantees compensation for its own obliquity. How much? Crystal's obliquity opens the Jaguar Road, around Tornado Island. Who knows what happens now? Wrench Boy harasses the weather. The exuberance of his mind stream merges with Jaguar's. An ever-growing wave field powers up for obliquity, varoom, and the garden stands up to Demesis. The mayor can't stand his ground. Peculiar, absurd, transparently mendacious stipulations of the fire chief devised to freeze us out with cold regulation. When sweet morning comes, Wrench Boy's still there in the straw-bestrewn bed tents, wise-assing the municipal doorkeep, Jaguar dancing an oblique, jig-like dance. Personality recedes, comes back again with a fresh bee in its bonnet. This is a list. Knots in the garden to get things started. Won't. Because of this, sacrifice silence. We young. We'll outlast the fire chief. Happenstance is a standing wave called in the great right. Street urchins have a purchase on Hammerhead in his grand white cloak. Jaguar slinks behind a red tree. He sacrifices his tea break and sets off to examine how jagged is the curvature down a long, long river. It will take some delicate tinkering by the likes of Wrench Boy to tease the track back on plot. Too much obliquity jiggers the pot. Obliquity implicitly brings its own sort of victory. What's really happening? I understand why one would ask such a question. Still, it is the wrong one. The point is, we are sitting in a garden though the weather is notorious. Rainy night, Featherbed Lane, and the cars go by. Another flavor of Black Lake. A fork once again, this time not only in the timeline, but in the way that exuberance exfoliates and with a magnanimous flourish just times out. To be young and swept away by people that actually make sense after a childhood of public absurdities. To be old and swept away by the young who actually make sense after a lifetime of universal absurdities. 100 fire chiefs in the night rain, 100 wrench boys, wrench girls with signs in front of the beer halls, in front of the bank. Now an old hotel without creature comforts, certainly, with no incentives for pointless heroics, when the fire chiefs ride over the rooftops on their noisy red engines, leading a cadre of hammerheads in various phases of dastardly and lethal exuberance. I understand very well how you all would form a chain of magnetic wrenches from form Congo lines and shake those African rattles. Only absurdity answers absurdity, that's a certainty. Existence itself can seem one's nemesis. You want to find out just who has a jaguar, who not, but unheroic difficulties take place obliquely to their imageries. You can't just chase them back. Obliquity once again. Obliquity once engaged, even in an opal, remains obliquity. What tricky business that solicits your allegiance, if any, do you follow? Sign here. You cogitate and dance, a plan, a path, strewn with petals of violets. Little likelihood they lead to a garden. Jaguar comes into focus. 3 a.m. Red engines head toward the battlements. Mechanical crocodiles loom and swoop. The plot resumes. The pot boils. Bubbling fluids or freezing mind states scour the pavements of the parks. The great wave trembles. The chain of magnetic wrenches holds for a moment. 10,000 spirits occupy the garden, then in a flash disperse. Deep storage empties. Nemesis is an army of mechanical crocodiles. Nemesis is the spooks of the fire chief devouring the tents in the garden. People scatter to their caves and elevators, their lacoliths and basoliths inside Broken Mountain, Jaguar and Wrench Girl in the vanguard. Nemesis is not that Melee abandons Wrench Boy, or Jaguar demands great sacrifice, or that ghosts exhaust the attitudes of Wrench Boy. We'll sleep, then do the rite of public assembly at whatever locus remains possible. Let happenstance and the wrong side of Hammerhead turn process into sacrifice as it may. Jaguars cogitate and jaguars circulate the gorge and watch the quincunks of tornadoes at Tornado Island as it were a garden of violets, and Nemesis meets its jaguar, and the country of courage never tires of the road. 22. A fork in the general spirit. Wrench boy on the fence. Not just a ghost from the gorge. Not this time. Jaguar, preternaturally quiet. Happenstance without a clue. A rift unfathomable. When we gaze in the gorge, a dark spirit flashes, then nothing. Deep storage evacuated, eviscerated. I shot up to the top of the sky, then zoomed down and looked at my shoes. Rubber galoshes in the stairwell, basement, fixed up with wooden panels, rain clothes, snow clothes hanging on hooks, a green woolen over jacket, little bowling pins. What did it smell like? Shoe polish, the convertible couch, the smell of its rough brown cover, what Hortense smelled like. And they say I had weak olfactories. Deep storage crowded, dense, one time laid out on another. No space, no totality. Printer's ink, Dectol. What is the sense of this silence? Jaguar thinks at last he understands. We've been asking all the wrong questions. Nemesis imposed upon intelligence. The spirit of the gorge has not exhausted deep storage. It's still there, gestating what the old ones euphemistically refer to even now as their African rattles. All is in question, but not the right question. What happened at Black Lake? Not a ripple, undone by feudal inquisition. What if it weren't courage that impelled the inquiry? Bifurcation, even in silence. Look the other way. African rattles over the hill. Jaguar collects a lexicon and intends to submit the entries to a jury of cognitive incendiaries. The idea is to cozen one's nemesis, take tea in inquiry's garden. Suddenly it seems as if there are lawyers everywhere, forensic technicians, laboratory specialists, personnel from the institute whose business it is to elaborate questions with professional efficiency and in a stringent lack of courtesy, not gardens of private inquiry, but agribusiness, thousands of acres dedicated to exhausting the industrial field, the product, inquiry itself, brought to a terrible focus. Is this the right question? Can one alone correct this in a night with that single African rattle essential to oneself, as if it were an opal planted in sleep, holy incubation, a temple equipped with precisely that question from the very beginning formulated just for you? There was a committee among authority. They planted a ghost in a crystal, the nemesis in it, suppressed, a time set aside for you to sit in your lair, alone with your African rattle, prepare for a private victory. You rented a chamber in the old hotel. You conjured your personal jaguar. You balanced his perspicacity, his intensity, with your prescient obliquity. You deployed your African rattle and its propensity for melee to hold her spirit at bay. You hired an adequate doorkeep. You could smell the proximity of victory. The old hotel was rife with precisely the wrong questions. Your jaguar poised to ask them. African rattles set to stun with interrogatives. The old hotel, the whole ancient edifice, the old ones who orchestrated schedule, all in the interrogative mood, exuberance for inquiry, permeates happenstance. There's a fork in obliquity, a victory garden to commemorate the inquiry. Density is superseded by continuum, whose points are all the questions you bring to the old hotel, all the right and the wrong ones. Jaguar, dislodged from happenstance, bestirs himself to think this. It's a trick. I don't believe it. He sits in the temple of continuity. It was never built out of points. Neither is it a garden. A fork in the being of inquiry. What possessed me? I am the grim incendiary. I bring conflagration to consciousness. I take out rooms in the old hotel just as you do. I am he who has mastered all the ghosts. I come to eviscerate courage, exhaust the life of the road. Long River is your nemesis, for it delivers all the wrong propositions. And what is a ghost but a question, an absence brought to a focus? Happenstance can never correct this. Even if the old hotel, where every room of it full of jaguars, come to make a sacrifice to happenstance, get straight to the point, no questions. African rattles come over the hill. You are sleeping the sleep of violets, entwined around the handsome handles of hammerhead. African rattles come over the hill to purge the old hotel. Interval. Jem Freak Jacinth lived in a jumble of kazoos and strung together beach detritus, but kept her opals in columns and rows, primed for the right. Night's excess, more night. It was Black Lake, in which her mind entire emitted fine luminous fibers to stretch across its own blackness. And if spirits were to manifest anywhere, it would be in a mind so accoutred and blackened with silence. Perfect obliquity permitted this. She wielded her own nemesis, as other practitioners consumed each other's happenstance. She stood as righteous sentinel before each excitement and enticement. No lethargy jaded her focus. A ring of forks, handle ends, stabbing the sod. And night creek, moonlit, cold real light, tickled the garden in tumbled huge stones in the gorge. The old hotel was on blue alert. Jaguars parked in a row before the great oak doors. Infinite courage charged Wrench Boy. Hammerhead was nervous and primed. 25. I'm excited about your opals, said the fence. He'd set himself up in the guise of a squint-eyed bursar in the narrow lobby of the old hotel, and he posted a small notice above the bars at the bourse to the effect that anyone's treasures, particularly opals, might be placed in safekeeping in a locked closet. No danger there slipping into some trough of deep storage. His mind was a garden of quirky devices. He knew well how to poison your silence. You don't put things in deep storage, I volunteered irritably. The thing puts you in its lists, or sometimes on notice. If you possess impertinent opals, they become separated from your arrangements. You go to sleep, and that itself is a rite that simply takes you into its arrangements, based no doubt on situations, the noonday garment of your noonday garden of your noonday life specify in their noonday spirit. One good opal arranges deep storage entire. Sleep is cleansed thereby, pure again, like crystal. No situation dreams this. But the clamoring of beach-strewn kazoos, jazzed up by a troupe of terrifying, goofy musicians, rides in on the dawn of a dream that cannot end. Black Lake sinks into the gorge, where silence is polluted by hammerheads. That's why his opal is clouded, and his focus seems incompetent to extend through his slumber. How do you purify silence? You ride Long River as long as you must, in sleep or in states of innocent exuberance, as happenstance or strenuous practice stimulates. No one knows what sleep is. You don't do it. It does you. In the middle of the melee of your noonday, it is your nemesis. In its proper allotment, your opal. I rode my African rattle right up to the fork where the gorge made opalescent dreams grow out of the ground from deep storage. A dream can be your nemesis. Wrench Boy was talking right out of his opal. Victory! The gorge is blooming with violets. Why? Why not? There was no necessity to obviate the muse in his opal. He could conjure whatever he wished right out of the depths, never apart from his crystal. Tornado Island is no stranger to exuberance. Its gardens in obliquity twist as tornadoes touch down. Two or five like the tines on your instrument. How many tornadoes locked into your perfect crystal? Hammerhead remembered his hire, Hammerhead. Idiocy redeemed by idiocy, filtered by opals, and the sound of African rattles rushing through his own extravagance. His mind was glutted with ghosts, a peculiar sensation, but he liked it. Better than ordinary slumber, anyway. Jaguar stood as the doorkeep of silence to keep it out until exuberance was quite exhausted and they all hung their African rattles up on their hooks. So this is the last of this run. At the end of the road, a doorkeep, gracious and relieved. No rigorous stipulations, no mean exclusions. Just open the door and allow whomever approaches go through. On the other side of the door, an enormous forest of African rattles, or else a great gourd surrounded by African rattles whose handles terminate in a five-tined fork. On the other side of the door, a path to Long River, and a ghost of a child offers his ghastly fingers as a hand to guide you to the rock behind the broken mountain where the path bifurcates. One way wends through a forest of African rattles, and all residual exuberance is sapped. At the end of the other, they give you at long last your opal. The road has been a long, long river all along, at the end of the river, Black Lake. With solemnity you agitate your African rattle, no matter which tine of the fork you happen to choose, which chooses you, an action prepared to drain off your last modicum of exuberance. On the other side of the door, your avatar of Hammerhead terminates all tendency in your nature to stimulate material or cognitive melee. Shake your African rattle and put this question. Is the end of the road a good thing? Open that door and a jaguar with a fistful of violets in his forepaw may or may not be your nemesis. One thing is certain. This is no ordinary garden here on Tornado Island, and deep storage has liberally opened its city of ghosts who traffic in a cold sort of exuberance. Nobody owns language, but all possess and deploy it as if it were their own. And there remains a ghastly doorkeep, and the door creaks as he pushes it. It gets heavier and harder to open onto such language as at the end of the road you wish to deploy. You slide through with difficulty if your mind is too portly, but the downward passage is dark and deep storage is empty. That is a good thing. Each lexical slot is replaced by a crystal. It's a good thing, too, you've come equipped with a fork, and quiet exuberance survives on account of your studied obliquity. And an African rattle is a versatile instrument, no matter the character or mood and office of the doorkeep. Over time, I've accumulated an impressive cache of African rattles. I use them to intensify my focus and catharize the qualities of my garden, keep those ghosts at bay, sleeping mostly. Yet I know no anodyne against narcolepsy more natural than an African rattle, unless it be an afternoon or evening well spent with red-haired melee. I've kept my exuberance as a sublimate once I learned the working of crystal. She herself may be your nemesis, with her silicon reicon full of motionless ghosts and her exemplary focus. But I've found a garden to which there is no path, and the spirits that attend it know well to compel Long River and exhibit consummate courage. Never tire of the road that starts nowhere, and you cannot cognize well on it, while on it, if it ever end. Jacinth hath no need to dissipate her exuberance, for her right itself acts as a doorkeep, and she shares her own nature with her ghosts, and Wrenchboy is her syzygy, that's a secret. And African rattle has its uses at well-defined ceremonial junctures. The road itself is like an old hotel, its spirit is composed of many byways. Deep storage is an index to everything, but resolves overnight to Black Lake. That should have been the last thing.
And, yeah,
the front. Oh, thank you. Yeah.
All right. Now, what I'll read is some ones that are in different moods.
You can see that there are these repeated entities: Black Lake, Old Hotel, Wrench Boy, Hammerhead, Crystal Violet, Opal, and so forth. And they undergo different permutations in the different texts. So I'm going to read now from the last one in the whole batch, or some from the last one in the whole batch. Called Views from Tornado Island. Sorry, just to... get there. I think I will. Nope, I won't. I have to go back. Okay, 5. Views from Tornado Island, 5. The wastrels are not zombies. They are as alert to changes in the scrappy lots wherein they are apt to put up their tents, if they have any. The wastrels are not zombies. They are as alert to changes in the scrappy lots wherein they are apt to put up their tents, if they have any, as a catboy who also has to shift with the agile breeze and the relative availability of invisible sights. Catboy knows Black Lake, while what these others know is, relative to them, invisible. There is a dredged canal around Tornado Island that cuts it off from the cliffs and fjords that otherwise surround the place, moats and other moats. You are not supposed to know it is there at all. You find it only if first you find the door in a place that shifts among palaces and watering holes, an antechamber or back room rumored to be where executive decisions are famously delivered among intimates and enemies. But the door to there isn't to there. You opened it, and whatever the anxieties and exigencies that led you to seek out such a place fall away utterly. A talking snake surprises you so shockingly that you have to accept the absolute difference that door has made, or fall into a cognitive melee so severe that no return to your private anxiety will dissolve it for you. What you see is a tower, but the bricks are oddly ordered, in contrary rows and circloids, giving the impression that the thing is rotating, but rotating in two senses simultaneously. You work at resolving what you think you see until suddenly there is no tower, but 5 tornadoes, and these in an instant resolve into 2, their funnels centered over a single black egg-like object, balanced on its slim end, precarious but unwobbling, while the 2 tornadoes now are turning in opposite senses. This is Tornado Island that sends all circles awry. You have seen it. It is inhabited by what may be elves or zombies, but you do not know exactly. You only know the door that opened you onto there. things have transpired, according to the motto, change will come. It came. The groove of quotidian ontological expenditures stopped being a groove, but you went on grooving. What could you do? Then someone stuck you with a fistful of violets in one hand and a black egg in the other. You had satisfied the preliminaries, and initiation was imminent. You were climbing the old tower staircase, being led by dwarves, not small people, but persons of an altogether different pedigree. Giantism and its antitype are absolute, not just a matter of impression, of relative size. Doors organize everything. There is more truth in them than in switches, their common binary notwithstanding. Lattices are governed by switches, but they have cords and patches and empty space, and they form totalities that their binaries don't add up to. Slowly, slowly, the parts come into their comparisons, but in an absolute sense. Everything flies together on a unitary gust or dust devil, then is off again if the wind continues to blow, released from the causalities that tied them up in a momentary knot-like process of a thing, although there are too many dimensions for that. Long River ties itself into an oxbow and unties itself, leaving itself right there for further water flow to form itself into and out of. Change has too many sub-moieties. Wrenchboy abandoned that general concept long ago. Try to channel your channel capacity. You need to weed out variants and stick to profile and type. That's why we have colonies. You ignore the havoc you commit whole worlds to, not to say destroy. The next world eggs laid from the abject ruins. Concepts are hypervigilant myths. Their motive is violent. In general, you can't say what they are. The operation of twins across absence is no twin of the concept. The doctor who took up all the rooms in the old hotel didn't want to stir the pot. He wanted to put an end to all that private listening in the basins on the to the bristles on the backs of wild pigs out of continents already deftly plundered. The problem was the door, the many doors in the one-sided wall that just stood there in the middle of the general lounge. The situation was constructing itself as if to make a point. It could put change to good use. If you want to get rid of elves or make them change, you have to specify a good deal more than that rather vague desideratum. Shall they disintegrate and reconvene as an egg? But you were climbing a tower and holding an egg, a black one at that, up a spiral staircase that was also going down, its double nature turning into itself, scattering the violets you were not certain you were supposed to keep on holding in your fists tenaciously. Was that an ordeal of the initiation? Wake up, little Susie. Catboy is kicking a black egg between his forepaws as the tower does its double thing from inside now. You are inside a tornado, or perhaps a few of them, and you can see at every window the head of a jaguar attempting to get you to hear, or under hear, something about small change and the price of initiation. Catboy out of Africa is the point of exchange between Wrenchboy and that big spotted cat. The path to sheer madness is paved with conceptual exigencies, insisted upon too vigorously, or experiences taken exception to. No light at the end of that tunnel, but a tower and a black egg whose nature itself comes into being at the other end of a ventriloquist's megaphone. When did they actually use that thing? The history of the megaphone, said Wrenchboy, has yet to be written, and if it has been written, I'll open a door to Long River and let its crystal waters discontinue that function for Catboy. It's hard enough dwelling under the insight that everywhere except elsewhere is a colony from which and from which alone we can harvest our African rattles. Six. There are African rattles of every description, stashed away or planted in plain sight, complained Lady Hammerhead, planted to separate those elves up to their necks in the sod. Every night the weirdlings rush up here and snatch the rattles and work up an uncanny fracas, and Wrenchboy tolerates the whole queer performance, though I do believe he's watchful. You can see him gazing fixedly into the people's cauldron as they dance, or whatever you call what they do, in an unkept ring around the tower, on nights when that hoary edifice does stand there. On all other nights they bestrew the whole island with black violets, everywhere up to the second channel outward, and inward to the place where the black egg balances, and the tower spins around both ways at once when it's there. She was standing on the rim of another cauldron, addressing her plaint to the ministers administering the switches of the tornado lattice and to the giant shadow that covered the colony to configure the night when it was night. On sultry afternoons, when the twisters spun round with grim, exultant life, the shadow just attached itself to the absent tower. Hammerhead came up to the melee that was his consort and examined her to determine whether the substance of her deliverances had been ventriloquized, whether the giant himself was sitting on the lattice, and how, in general, matters stood in the colony. Long River was boiling practically up to the tower. Black violets were hopping on the wind. There were weird little doors opening invitingly and slamming shut as you approached, distributed elegantly, but virtually everywhere. The ventriloquists were chattering. Voices and irascible messages accosted you distractedly, seductively, or menacingly, or boycotted your presence annoyingly if you hazarded response. The giant was attempting to extirpate his own shadow. Hammerhead tried to recover control of the lattice, for the elves that manned the switches were in full revolt. The voices, apparently, all over the colony, were searching for their twins, and rather than ignore what they heard, the elves were jiggerbugging to the tune of it, repeating it to luminous blue bugs and long-tentacled, spider-like fleshy things, and under pretense of obedience and staunch civic duty, were throwing the switches in a thoroughly random fashion. Hallucinogenic elf miniatures were manifesting everywhere, popping out of vessels, glass and earthenware and porcelain, each urn or vase or kettle asserting the authority of its place, refused to move, and whatever the peculiar function it knew how to perform uncustomarily, it started performing now. Soup spilled over, flower pots blossomed, ornamental ware sported fantastic ornaments. The giant himself was a chorus of voices, weird announcements bellowing out of his buttonholes. Everyone into the chasm. Burn down the old hotel. Follow that tornado. This is your fault, a voice came out of Hammerhead, apparently addressing his wife. You ate the lattice of place itself. Wrenchboy sidled up to Hammerhead and suggested, best we get back to Black Lake. But the elves were listening. They rushed into the door when it opened, and an enormous company arrived on the hallowed shores. The ventriloquist had set up a cabana on the beachhead, but its function that sent out voices to so many recipients had sucked out all the sound of the local apparatus, and an impenetrable silence now reigned at the absolute source. The lake couldn't muster a ripple. The ventriloquist himself required his own ventriloquist. That would be Jaguar. Chaos is an egg. The ventriloquist's ventriloquist pronounced this with grandiloquent solemnity. The giant placed his cudgel in deep storage. The magnificent crystal that hovered perennially above Tornado Island went through her full repertoire of spectacular luminous scatterings, and all the beasts of the melee changed the channel. 7. The flies were mutating extravagantly in the extravagant tropical heat, zooming in spirals and darting all across the colony. The zombies and avatars of everyone were out on the porches, frantically swatting and shaking their rattles. This was not the proper deployment of these instruments, and it didn't work. The pattern of movement was the main thing. When each insect completed its singular gyration, it turned to the blue vat wherein it had gestated. The elves were still planted up to their necks in the sod. They, too, were mutating. Each had a twin far away on its own unapproachable mainland. And when the twin changed over there, its sibling here on Tornado Island changed in a complementary manner. If the boots of the sibling changed color, the hat of the twin sprouted feathers. That's an example. The sum of such changes comprised the matrix.
I am not the ventriloquist or the ventriloquist emitting these missives. I have only partial responsibility for the veritable melee that is perhaps their general character. That there is a matrix limiting the disorder is my discovery, not my invention. I am myself my own twin. That is the odd thing about having one. Everyone is an orphan. Everyone is double. It takes two to make a one. Her name is Violet. The unapproachable mainland is like an old hotel. It seems like a dream from here. Long River surrounds me. It comes from afar, then veers away, and you cannot decide the direction. The lattice decides. That is the visible form of the matrix. The difference between image and archetype compels a twist in the real. That is the turbulence of the cauldron. But the clear light is like crystal, like water, condensed in the heat on cool glass. The picture windows of the old hotel and the grand lawns covered with violets and the long river viewable through them from inside the great lounges or reflected in them, seen from the lawns. The colonies are occupied by pictures. The weirdlings propagate of themselves to stake out a territory. A jumble of doubles and facades, of old hotels and factories inhabited by checkered snakes that morph at will into sentinels and busboys. The old hotels, though but shadows, have need of employees. Cat boys scabber about toting luggage. The old hotels are inhabited by entities from elsewhere. There have to be racemes of violets, slightly gone in the morning, not to be replaced each morning, but reeking with the scent of a just senescent melee, that fading flower. The jaguars come in here from the jungle to restore a semblance of order. The lattice itself exhibits only a semblance of order. The matrix is controlled by the ventriloquist. He gives a twist to his glottis, and the music skips a pitch in the lounges. The violets wither slightly, blacken a little, the petals beginning to crumble, but are good for one day and another. Cat boys are slow to inspect them, but slowness is quick enough. Melee herself has a twin well-defined in the lattice. You climb the tower, in gray weather, up the twisted staircase, to the chamber where the black egg is housed. When the old hotel gives a signal, the gigantic chalice in the foyer starts to gurgle and gives off an uncanny glow. It holds Black Lake, but only the giant who occupies the entire lounge sofa knows it. The perfect crystal star that floats above it is so set that though visible from everywhere, nobody knows it. The twisted stems of a violet, a cat boy sticks in his buttonhole, and the whole colony is festooned with violets. Now I'm going to read one more thing that's there are ones that are not in the system, but are just improvisations, and they're called intervals. So this is called an interval. Tornado Island was the quasi-geophysical matrix of initiates to come. A strange boy in a cement factory gazing into the blue mephitic pool of elixirs long disqualified. From the dead come the dead. That's a motto. Can you purchase his services? Pondered Lady Hammerhead. To scry up requisite remedies, or must I produce my own boy tool, my own cement factory? The idea was to generate, summon, collocate, or gather in the discarnate materials for the great initiate appropriate to the epic. And right there was her errancy. She thought she belonged to an epic, rather than that she herself was a powder in another sorcerer's pill. Itself a compound of the fantasy of a time framed for such purposes to contain, the time were framed to contain. If you have a bottle, its hollows are not articulate spaces merely. They are the epochs between the point on the glazier's calendar at which they were delicately blown, and that at which some contingency might smash them. the calendar itself being a phantasmatical imposition upon Tornado Island, whose rotations, counter-rotations, iterations, and variable regularity themselves require a giant's mind to set them swirling, and so on back and forth to the point itself where what the Indo-Europeans stumbled upon as being, if it was that hypothetical clan from the indefinite north that did so chance upon it. You see what I mean? In any case, this should be sufficient to disorient Lady Hammerhead and set her off to chanting another anthem. But the boy was not a phantasm. He sat in a quiet cabinet at the bottommost basement of Tornado Tower, concentrated profoundly on a stone that was no farmland's hen's egg, but rough and shining black obsidian, his head ever so slightly tilted to the right, his perch another stone, and through the night he did not act, he did not wait. Okay. Stop there. Is that enough? Should I tell what the system is? Is that, would that be interesting?
Or, yeah.
About 3 years ago, I was staying at Megan's family's place in Pennsylvania and going and sitting in Barnes & Noble's every couple of days and just pulling books off the bookshelves and gobbling them. And I kept noticing a big, fat book on codes. And I was sort of thinking, I'd like to learn something about the really sophisticated code systems, like the Enigma code that was the famous Second World War code, and what's behind all of these complicated systems that are so secret. You can't really know what's happening in cryptology because the government gobbles up exactly what. So I took the book off the shelf and I started studying it. And very quickly, I learned from the very beginning that you have very simple codes, which are substitution codes. You make something that substitutes for A, B, C, D, E, F, C, G. Then the next level of a code would be a transposition code, in which you take the initial code and by some system make a second step of changes. So you could say, the simplest one, and this is the one that I eventually used, is you say, whatever is given as A is actually B, and whatever is given as B is actually C, and you bump them down one letter to the end, and Z becomes A. So you have an initial code, then a transposition, which moves them. And I realized that I wanted to write something that used a code like that, so I very quickly wrote down 26 different objects or words or names that just came out of my head and were some objects that were concerned with me, and I now had a code of 26 things connected to the alphabet. And I took a phrase, and it was a phrase that was obsessing me and still obsesses me as the what ought to be the term for the Great Revolution. Money has an enemy. That was my phrase, and I actually propagate this. I think that should be proposed. You just say money has an enemy, and obviously, it's not you, it's not me, but there is no one who's money's enemy, and therefore that phrase stands as an actual edge to the entire present world system. But, so money has an enemy. So I write down M-O-N-E-Y-H-A-S, so forth, put the symbols for those letters next to them, and then I improvise a poem in which I have to get from one letter to the next. So if M is Wrench Boy, and O is Black Lake, and N is Hammerhead, and E is whatever, I have to have a poem that starts with Wrench Boy, and then gets somehow to
Black Lake and then gets somehow to Hammerhead and just moves through it. And so I go through Money Has an Enemy until I've written a poem that has that as its system. Then, of course, there are all the letters in the alphabet that aren't contained in M-O-N-E-Y and so forth. So I go into the poem that I've written, find words that have the letters that I haven't used, write them, write the code down for them, and continue until I've exhausted the entire alphabet. And then I've got a poem that has this system in it. So I read this to a student of mine, friend student, and he gets very interested in it. And he says, well, why don't you just go ahead now and do the transpositions? So I thought that was interesting. So I bump it. Now, if M was Wrench Boy, now, I mean, if A was Wrench Boy, now B is Wrench Boy. So I transpose them all one letter. And as soon as I had done that two times, I realized that what happens when you do that is that the density of the signifiers, the density of the coded words changes. So you get something like the Scrabble code or the Goldbug code, where the most common letter is E. So whichever symbol is E is going to be the main thing that's going to appear in whatever occurs. So I got into doing it, and sort of it started to generate stories and generate material. And I went through the entire alphabet. That is to say, I did 26 transpositions, so that every letter became every other one, and that produced an entire business. And I didn't want to stop, so I did The Money Has an Enemy 4 bloody times. As that started happening, the identities of these figures started to accumulate, and the stories started to accumulate. And 4 times through was, about 450 pages of it. And then I stopped, but then I didn't want to stop because it was all in my head, and so I started using other phrases and varying it. And that's what went on for over two years. And now I'm in the situation of trying to actually compose a coherent or incoherent or whatever it is thing, whatever this is, what is involved in it. Because it generated all this writing, all these stories, all this material. That's where I am with it. But you can see how it was a kind of implosion of the Forest for the Trees situation. Because now I have a bounded thing within the Forest for the Trees, which has the same question as the Forest for the Trees, except instead of it being just whatever I happen to write coming out of that background, it's coming out of this very, very elaborate matrix, reflecting on itself and generating mythologies about itself and so on. That's my existence.
I love the way you read that stuff, Chuck. It just, I keep thinking of Chuck through the Looking Glass.
Well, or inside Black Lake, or inside the Opal, or the sounds that come out of the African Rattle, or the rooms in the old hotel, or it's like, these are, I haven't figured out a way of actually delivering what the whole sense of it is in a short compass. So it's somewhat arbitrary how I give it. But also the thing is that it produces my own desire to generate voices, and that becomes part of it too.